Ministry of Defense, but actually it has been used extensively by the Russian regime to do all the black, very nasty things, not just in Ukraine, but in many regions of the world, in Syria, in Africa. We actually had recently a call of solidarity with activists from different African countries, from Sudan to South Africa and Mauritius. And we learned a lot about this presence of Wagner Group there. And actually, Sudan was the first country that was targeted by Wagner mercenaries when the now ousted dictator Omar Bashir led them into his country, and in a very neo-colonial or even classical 19th century colonialism way of doing things, they started looting the natural resources, namely the gold of the country, and they were very heavily involved into all the conflicts there. And now we are inside another conflict in Sudan, where both sides have links to Russia and have links to the Wagner Group, and specifically, like the head of the Janjaweed, who was responsible for the Darfur genocide and who is now waging this war against other generals in Sudan. He was in Moscow on the day of Russia's invasion of Ukraine and assured Putin his full support. So this was only the starting point, and ultimately Wagner became some backbone for many military dictatorships in several African countries. So it seems that they are very ruthless. They include people who are also coming from a far-right white supremacist background. They are usually linked to lots of war crimes, both in the Middle East, in Africa, and in Ukraine. And it seems that Prigozhin tries to grab every opportunity, every publicity, to probably make his appearance even more notorious, because he wants to use this in some possible future power struggle inside Russia. So it seems that he tries to underline like his importance both in internal and foreign policy of Russia. And this makes him an even more notorious figure for many people in the post-Soviet space, who are afraid that even if Putin's regime is gone, it may be replaced with something like this kind of even more outright ultra-nationalist and militarist regime like Prigozhin.
Yeah, and only to add that a recent UN report accused Wagner mercenaries of involvement in a March 2022 massacre in a village in Mali, where nearly 500 people were killed. I'd like to go now to Professor Gregory Afanigenev. You're a professor of Russian history. Your recent piece for Jacobin is headlined, "Peace in Ukraine Isn't Coming Soon." Could you explain why you believe peace negotiations are not possible at the moment, and indeed why you make the argument that the question is not so much of the U.S. pushing Ukraine to negotiate, but that whatever agreement is reached would result in a very long-standing standoff between Ukraine and Russia, akin to what happened in Korea or Nagorno-Karabakh?
Yeah, I think if you look at the context of what's happening in both Ukrainian and Russian societies as a result of the invasion, both societies are becoming highly polarized, in which obviously in Russia, liberals have been not only imprisoned, but effectively exiled or threatened with conscription, massive fines, and so on. But even passive supporters of the invasion are held to a particular standard in terms of even high-profile supporters have had their private phone calls leaked in what appears to be, an attempt by the state to threaten them. And, of course, this has also affected the way that the elite competition plays out, as Denise mentioned with Prigozhin, right? The Russian elite that is competing now for the spot of designated heir to Putin wants to be seen as more militaristic, wants to be seen as more patriotic, more aggressive than its rivals. And any of the sort of soft technocratic liberals that you might have seen 10 years ago have largely been cowed into submission or disappeared, not to say that they would be any better necessarily. And of course, in Ukrainian society, positions that were more or less socially consensus or at least a solid middle ground 10, 15 years ago have now become symptomatic of dedication to Putinism or support for Russia that is now grounds for essentially removal from Ukrainian political life. And so the sole legitimate contenders for political power in Ukraine are highly nationalist and highly bent on recovering the territories lost to Russia, which of course is completely understandable considering the awful, horrendous nature of this invasion and the true scope of all the lives and the land has been lost. So as a result, you know, this is not something that the U.S. has caused. It's not something that the U.S. is, the U.S. is perpetuating it in the sense that it's preventing Ukraine from losing. But the underlying social tensions here are not something that the U.S. can remove by asking for negotiations. These societies are now deeply at odds in a way that's going to persist for many, many years.
And you've said, as against recent speculations, you've said that Russia has been preparing politically for this war for at least a decade. Could you explain what you mean by that and how so?
I think the sequence of events that started with the U.S. invasion of Libya and also with the opposition Bolotnaya protests in Russia right around the same moment in 2011, I think this was a moment of reckoning for Putin in the sense that he believed that unless he changed things very radically, he would be at risk of some kind of regime change internal operation. Now, whether that's justified or not, I can't say, but and that's not to say that this wasn't based on a paranoid fantasy, and it is. Of course, it's linked to an idea of the West not too distant from DeSantis's, right, as something that is a force for, that is a kind of woke virus that seeks to implant liberalism everywhere around the world and, you know, remove respect for traditional values and so on, right? So the invasion of Ukraine was the sort of foreign policy version of that initiative. And when Maidan took place, Putin realized that he could not do to Ukraine what he had previously done to Belarus, which is to make it a highly politically authoritarian and highly politically subservient puppet state, and which has gotten even worse, of course, since 2020, when the pro-democracy protests were brutally suppressed. So the military route here is an attempt by Putin to ensure that that there is no sort of visible post-Soviet challenge to the Russian world order or the Russian image of the world order. Now, the failure of this invasion, of course, it's good news for Ukrainians, but it's not necessarily good news for Russian foreign policy. I think it reflects that it kind of reflects the sense, at least for me, that the regime is entering a kind of spiral of aggression and internal dysfunction that is not at risk of ending anytime soon.
So, Denis Pilash, could you respond to what Professor Afanyi-Ganev said? And also, you know, you're a socialist activist. If you could explain where the left in Ukraine now stands on this war. You've mentioned that the left in Ukraine describes the situation as, quote, surviving between Russian tanks and Western banks. Could you elaborate?
Okay, so yes, I would just add probably that this type of thinking that is now manifested by the Kremlin elites and Putin himself, it's very akin to some kind of Western far-right conspiracy theories, and it's deeply rooted in the persuasion that no kind of inner change, no kind of revolution, no kind of popular revolt is possible without any foreign meddling. So they consider any kind of popular unrest as something that is somehow manufactured by the foreign enemies and competitors of your state. So actually, this is a deeply conservative worldview. And of course, it's based on, first of all, this very deep fear of their own people, that ultimately some kind of new revolution is possible also in the Russian Federation. So this makes Russia some kind of, like in 19th century, Tsar Nicholas I was called the Gendarme of Europe, as he was suppressing the revolutionary movements like in Hungary. So in this way, they also tried to act in the post-Soviet space as these conservative safeguards, helping the authoritarian regimes to keep their populations in cages, essentially. But to speak about, to address the situation of the Ukrainian left, so yes, we are in this challenge that together with the entire population of Ukraine, we are we need to do this existential fight essentially for the survival of Ukraine as a separate entity, as a separate republic, but also we need to preserve this space for democratic action and to preserve the space for social change. And this is very deeply connected with the issues of already wartime economy and post-war reconstruction, as what has been exposed at international forums like the Lugano conference, and now there will be another conference in London dedicated to the post-war reconstruction of Ukraine. Both the Ukrainian and Western ruling classes, they tend to apply mostly very pro-market, very business-friendly and business-oriented approaches in this reconstruction, and essentially they will try also to use the situation that was created by this Russian war of aggression to further like make more offensive on the social state and the public sector in Ukraine. While we, as Ukrainian leftists, socialists, trade unionists, feminists, environmentalists, and other activists, we feel that, on the contrary, the country that has been so heavily torn by the war, it needs expansion of the welfare state. It needs expansion of the public sectors, as we will have, we already have a huge need in social housing. This shouldn't be left to corrupt private contractors that have been already destroying our cities from inside. We will have an enormous number of people with who were injured in the war, people with disabilities, with PTSD, and this means that we need more hospitals, we need more medical and psychological help, and we also need to create protection for those who have been affected by the war, for the veterans and for the civilians alike. And actually, this is a kind of reconstruction that was in many European countries after the victory over the fascist Axis in the Second World War, when actually the working classes and organized labor, trade unions, in many places, they were empowered by this anti-fascist victory enthusiasm, and they could pressure their governments to more concessions and to a more socially oriented, more socially just way of reconstructing the economy and the country in general. So this, I think this is also a point where an international left and international progressive movements also can make a difference by pressuring their governments to a more socially, genderly, ecologically just reconstruction of Ukraine, and also taking the issue of Ukraine into the bigger picture of the countries of the periphery. And we actually, at our journal Commons, now launched a project called Dialogue with the Peripheries, because we feel that people in Ukraine and Central Eastern Europe in general, they need to build more bridges with the so-called Global South, with the peoples of Latin America, Africa, Asia, because we face different, we have different histories and different colonial and imperialist oppressors, but actually we face very similar patterns of dependency, and we actually need to counter them together in solidarity for instance, such cases as debt cancellation. Again, you cannot have a running war economy and post-war economy when your country is obliged to this vicious circle of debt. And Ukraine isn't the first one that was trapped inside. So we need to build this more internationalist and more global front for change that would defy any kind of imperialists in any forms. be it the Russian tanks, yes, the direct brute force that is espoused by Russia, not just in Ukraine, but in many other places, or more sneaky kinds of other forms of dependency that can be, for instance, imposed by the international financial organizations.
So, Professor Afanaganov, if you could respond to what Dennis said, you have also pointed out that the war has been a kind of shock doctrine for rapidly accelerating the new liberalization of Ukrainian society. If you could elaborate on that and also respond to what kinds of reconstruction aid is required now in Ukraine and where that might come from.
Yeah, the shock doctrine, I mean, it's very clear. It's almost a textbook case, right? So Zelensky's party, Servant of the People, originally proposed a slate of reforms to the pension law and to labor law in Ukraine that were highly radical. In fact, it would eliminate the ability for labor unions to collectively bargain before the war. And they were unable to do so. They didn't have enough support in the Rada. After the war, there was, of course, a rally around the flag effect, and many of the leading opposition parties, in fact, all of them, were banned, although their deputies remained in the Rada, and they were able to pass these reforms, which, even the ILO has criticized. These are not middle-of-the-road reforms. They are the far right of the neoliberal European consensus, essentially. And they're made use of it by the fact that the Zelensky government counts on not having any social mobilization against it because everyone is so focused on saving their loved ones from the Russian invasion, and in allowing the state to do what it needs to do, to protect the country. And I want to point out here that it's not just Zelensky doing this himself, right? This is EU aid comes with a slate of conditions that strongly encourage this neoliberal turn. And of course, it's all framed as, getting rid of inefficient Soviet era institutions and so on. But it amounts to a massive reduction in social welfare spending, all of this reform. So it really is a question of what kind of Ukraine survives this conflict. Is it going to be a Ukraine that effectively, as I put it in my piece, right, is a gigantic special economic zone that has certain trade privileges in relation to Europe, but has much weaker labor protections? Or is it going to be a country that's just and actually offers a place to live for its millions of people that is better than the Russian alternative, which I think can easily happen. But the EU is bent on imposing its neoliberal ideology on the recipients of its aid. And I think it's really important to address the second part of your question here. I think it's really important to take the spotlight away from the question of military aid, which, yes, is essential for Ukraine's survival. But the much greater needs of civilian reconstruction right now are barely being discussed because the weapons have taken up so much of the space. But it's the civilian reconstruction, debt cancellation in particular, as I think is very essential, and the removal of conditionalities on this kind of aid so as to remove the Zelensky government's ability to wield those conditions to force out left-wing political forces in Ukrainian society. And perhaps even use some of the levers of that aid to pressure Zelensky to withdraw some of his attempts to monopolize public space. There have been documented instances, for example, of protesters on all kinds of issues, not even strongly political ones, being drafted or threatened with conscription and being sent to the front as a result of their political activities. This is extremely troubling because it's directly threatening protesters with violence, right? And the state currently has not a lot of coercive resources left, but if the war ends and it still has the same degree of intervention in street politics, that's not going to be good news for Ukrainian democracy.
Well, could you also talk about how the war appears to be spreading beyond the borders of Ukraine? There was the recent drone attack on the Kremlin, and just this week, the cross-border raids by pro-Ukrainian Russian forces attacking the Belgorod region of Russia. So, I mean, what are your concerns about this potentially escalating to the point, that is potentially devastating for the area, but also potentially the world. And even though you have reservations about a possible ceasefire ending in something like the Nagorno-Karabakh situation or Korea, wouldn't a ceasefire nevertheless result in fewer and possibly no lives lost on the Ukrainian side?
I mean, I would like to think that, yes. I think a ceasefire certainly would be better than most of the available options at this point. The difficulty with these current cross-border attacks and the other terrorist, well, and the other, you know, acts of sabotage and so on, which from a military point of view are totally defensible, but it's important to understand that these are not volunteer groups in any meaningful sense. These are clients of the Ukrainian security services, right? And what they appear to be doing is they appear to be registering that Western governments are starting to weary of their open-ended commitment to Ukrainian military defense, and I think are trying to provoke Russia into some kind of radical course of action that's going to force the U.S. and NATO to take a more radical position. And in doing, and so they're trying to stage these kinds of attacks as more and more obvious in an attempt to get something like this to happen. Obviously, that is extremely risky as a strategy, right? The risks of this war spiraling out into a nuclear or even a larger scale conventional conflict are not great. But at the same time, it's important to remember that because of the way that these forces are established within Ukrainian society, right, a ceasefire would not prevent this kind of thing from happening. There would be people both in Ukraine and in Russia interested in an immediate resumption of the conflict on any premises, and they would work to constantly sabotage this peace, and they would be able to say, look, these are just volunteers, these are just partisans, and both within Ukraine and within Russia, you have to remember, for example, that Wagner began as a plausibly deniable non-state organization. So it's really important to remember the broader stakes of this conflict and work towards a long-term resolution rather than just trying to stop the bleeding and hoping for the best.
Denis Pilash, your final comments. We just have 30 seconds.
Sorry. I would say that it's quite important now to keep solidarity with the people of Ukraine. And this means that, yes, it needs we need all kinds of support. This includes actually military support, but it also includes this kind of humanitarian aid and resuming the political questions like cancellation of the Ukrainian debt.
Thank you so much, Denis Pilash, Ukrainian political scientist and historian. And thank you, too, to Gregory Afanogenev, professor of Russian history at Georgetown University. We'll link to your recent piece in Jacobin headlined, Peace in Ukraine Isn't Coming Soon. Coming up next, a new report from Oxfam finds G7 countries collectively owe poor nations in the global south more than $13 trillion in development and climate assistance. Back in 30 seconds. I Don't Want to Fight by Tina Turner, who's passed away Wednesday at the age of 83. We end today's show with a new Oxfam report that shows G7 countries collectively owe poor nations in the global south more than $13 trillion in development and climate assistance. But instead, these countries are saddled with daily debt repayments of $232 million, deepening the global chasm of inequality. To talk more about this, we go now to New Delhi, India, where we're joined by Amitabh Behar, Interim Executive Director of Oxfam International. Welcome to Democracy Now, Amitabh Behar. If you could lay out what this report found, the Oxfam report.
The report is essentially talking about how we need to really relook at the narrative. the current narrative where we talk of G7 as these charitable global leaders, which actually should be getting resources in terms of debt repayment from the low and middle income countries, needs to be completely transformed. You know, we need to change the gaze. The gaze is essentially where we need to look at what do the G7 countries owe to the poor in the middle income countries. So I think that change is critical. And as you said, our report clearly says that the G7 countries owe $13.3 trillion to the low and middle income countries. So that's massive. So this is in the form of the non-payment of aid and not putting resources in climate action. So that's really the story. And when the G7 is met in Hiroshima, they were talking about zero hunger, they were talking of climate action, but they did not really look at what their responsibility is.
And Amitabh, if you could elaborate on that, you've said the huge costs from climate damage caused by the, quote, reckless burning of fossil fuels by rich countries needs to be addressed here as part of the debt. What are you calling for?
If you look at the commitments that were made by G7, they said from 22 to 25, they were going to invest $100 billion every year. And we've not really seen that money come. And if you increasingly look at the massive damages happening because of the climate crisis, particularly in the South, somebody needs to take responsibility for that. And it's fairly clear, report after report, that the G7 countries are significantly responsible for these emissions. And at this moment, as our report says, that they almost owe $8.7 trillion in terms of loss and damages. So that's something that must be put up front by the G7 countries, but that's not happening. And then the second part is that in 1970, the G7 countries agreed to a 0.7 of GNI as ODA, but we have still now not even seen half of that money getting realized. So there are massive shortfalls, deficits in terms of the money that G7 owes to the developing countries.
And Amitabh Bihar, if you could explain what the concrete effects of these crippling debt payments are on the global South. This comes as a global hunger crisis has risen for the fifth consecutive year. Talk about the impact on individual states of these debt repayments and where the money is taken from to repay the debt.
Absolutely. I think that's also very central to our report, that the 230 million that goes out every day in terms of debt repayment, which is going to go to the coffers of the G7 countries and also a lot of rich bankers, is essentially the money that could have been invested in education, in health, in gender justice programs, in ensuring safe drinking water, in climate resilience. But that's the money that's going back to the G7 countries. And this is happening in the context of the polycrisis that we are witnessing. As you said, fifth year, we are seeing in a row where hunger is rising. Almost 280 million plus people sleep hungry every night. And this is the time when this whole debt crisis is being talked of. And you know, this is also in that context of the fuel crisis. You're looking at inflation. So even the cost of debt repayment is going higher as the dollar cost goes up. So in the context of the poly crisis, this is really hypocrisy to say that G7 is taking global leadership, while it's the schools and the public health system, safe drinking water, which is getting taken away from the poor and the excluded communities.
And Amitabh, we have just 30 seconds. If you could say how humanitarian aid fits into it, the inadequacy of it, and what needs to be done.
It's extremely inadequate. It's fairly clear that the need for humanitarian aid is just growing. And that's growing because what we're looking at, you know, the poly crisis is also in terms of inequality, the climate crisis, conflicts. These are all coming together. And at this juncture, the humanitarian aid is galloping in terms of the need manyfold. But the commitments are very, very hollow.
So I'm afraid we're going to have really to leave it there. Amitabh Behar, Interim Executive Director of Oxfam International, speaking to us from Delhi. And that does it for its show. I'm Amy Goodman. I'm Nermeen.
Broadcasting on the Internet and at 90.1 FM from high atop Burnaby Mountain, you're listening to CJSF 90.1 FM.